from deep inside your radio.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, recount, I guess, is the word of the day. Who was it that was saying it in Florida? It was the Democrats, it was the Republicans, everybody was saying recount. Then they said, let's stop recounting. Somebody said that. I think four guys and a gal. I don't remember. Anyway, recounting is all the vogue again. The Federal Communications Commission is contemplating a creative way. We look to the FCC for creativity, don't we? Please? To advance the stalled transition to digital television. Hey, who told you it was going to stall? Who told you to stall it? Hands? Thank you. And to sell vacated frequencies for billions of dollars. Well, we could sell the frequencies that digital TV is on for billions of dollars. Stay where we are. No, we can't do that. We must move forward. All right, sources familiar with the plan say that here's how it works. You see, television broadcasters have to give up their analog airwaves at the end of 2006 or when 85% of the public can receive digital signals, whichever comes later. 2006 deadline, of course, is not going to be met. There's no estimate of when the transition will be complete. Since roughly 85% of the U.S. subscribe to cable or satellite, FCC Chairman Michael Powell, son of Colin, is weighing whether to count those homes as capable of receiving digital signals, whether or not their cable or satellite system passes through all the digital signals, you see. This would instantly achieve the goal in many television markets. Subscribers who have a digital television set would enjoy the crisper signals. That's from Reuters. Yes, they're crisper, unless they reduce the bit rate, in which case they're crisp crap. And for the majority who do not yet have a digital-ready set, they would receive a signal that has been converted back to analog, so they're not left in the dark. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm the lucky recipient of, through my cable system, signals that are converted back from digital to analog. You don't want to see television that looks like that. It looks like it's been sewed into a wool scarf, the picture does. Your morning oatmeal looks less grainy than this picture. Already, most local television stations are broadcasting in digital over the air, but few consumers are receiving it. The transition so far has been slowed by the high price of digital equipment, availability of programming, and the basically crappy nature of the whole idea. Oh, that's me. I'm sorry. Well, it is me, of course. The FCC has ordered the new largest man came in. Under the new concept, many markets will reach the 85% threshold by 2005 or 2006. That would free up the valuable analog airwaves, which will be auctioned to wireless providers, likely for billions. An FCC spokeswoman declined to comment. The trial balloon could get shot down in a number of ways, including if the interpretation of the 85% reach cannot pass judicial muster. Says the broadcaster's lobby, we have a variety of concerns. He declined to elaborate. Says the cable spokesperson, the broadcast industry's only plan seems to be to occupy analog and digital spectrum indefinitely. Well, I've heard worse plans. And if you don't like the recount, don't count. The Bush administration threatened to fire a top Medicare official if he gave data to Congress showing the high costs of hotly contested Medicare legislation. The official, Richard Foster, the chief actuary of the Medicare program, said he'd been formally told not to provide the information to Congress. He said he was told the consequences of insubordination would be, quote, very severe. Senior officials of the Medicare agency made it clear they would try to fire me for responding directly to inquiries from Congress, Foster said. He'd received that message from Thomas Scully, then administrator of the Medicare program. Scully confirms having told him to withhold certain information from Congress. A White House spokesperson declined to comment. But the spokesperson said he did not know if anyone had threatened to dismiss Foster. The House and Senate approved Medicare bills, being assured that the cost would not exceed $400 billion over 10 years. Just 2 weeks earlier, Foster estimated the drug benefits in a bill very similar would cost $550 billion. All of our estimates, he said, showed the cost of the drug benefits would be in the range of $500 to $600 billion. Those cost estimates were all provided to his boss, Scully. Some were sent to the White House. The White House confirmed they'd received those estimates. Foster was an actuary at Social Security before being at Medicare. Tom Scully told my staff, said another source, that Rick Foster would be fired so fast his head would spin if he released this information to the Congress. So, recount or don't count. It's all the same when you're, hello, welcome to the show.
Haley's waitress never comes around. She's hiding in the kitchen. She's nowhere to be found. I just want some coffee. Is that too much to ask? Haley's waitress is not up to the task.
From the edge of America, from the home of the homeless, I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to Le Show. Hey, how you doing? You think NBC's going to go for arena baseball if this football thing works out? That would be cool. That would really, because, you know, baseball looks so good inside. Here's the good news, ladies and gentlemen. The pell-mell rush to e-voting may have hit a big speed bump. California legislators said this week they want to stop the use of all paperless electronic voting machines in the state. The chairman and vice president of the Senate Elections Committee sent a letter to the Secretary of State, not Colin Powell, the California Secretary of State, urging him to decertify all paperless touchscreen voting machines before the general election. March 2 primary was a test flight of widespread use of these machines. I think it's fair to say the test flight crashed and burned, says Don Parada of Oakland, chairman of the Senate Election Committee. None of us want California to be the next Florida. I don't know. I wouldn't mind some old people wandering by, shuffling by some very thin models in Art Deco hotels. What about you? The senator cited malfunctions of e-voting machines during the primary that resulted in voters being turned away from the polls. They said the presidential election was too important to leave to the new machines. Counties would be forced to use old-style optical scan machines instead. They use a paper ballot that voters mark with a pencil or pen. How horse and buggy can you get? Next thing you know, they'll be watching analog television. All counties using paperless systems are required to have backup print options. Most counties possess only one or two such scan units, which they generally use to process absentee ballots. The need for the moratorium became apparent after malfunctioning machines in the March primary, as we said, prevented many people from voting. In Orange County, about 7,000 workers got the wrong ballots. It resulted in ballots being cast for the wrong legislative districts. In 21 precincts, more votes were cast than there were registered voters. Hey, that's FCC-type counting. In San Diego, 30% of the precincts failed to open on time because of problems with the machines. How about paper and a thing? Ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to say it one more time. Are you in a hurry for the results? Am I? You know who's in a hurry for the results. CBS, NBC, ABC, CNN, Fox, MSNBC. That's it. I can wait till the morning. I really can. We're going to be stuck with whoever it is for 4 years. I can wait till Wednesday morning. I can wait till Thursday. I can wait a month like we did. So why don't we just all go back to taking a pen, taking a piece of paper, sound effect, going like that. I know, put a lot of electronics manufacturers, they'll have to supply defective voting machines to Taiwan instead. But I'm going to say it one more time, paper ballots, ladies and gentlemen, an idea whose time has come back. I can wait. I really can. All right, on to bigger fish. A new classified intelligence report presented to the White House last week detailed for the first time the extent to which Pakistan's Khan Research Labs provided North Korea with all the equipment and technology that needed to produce uranium-based nuclear weapons. All of it from our friends in Pakistan. We attacked Iraq. Pakistan was providing North Korea with all the equipment and technology it needed to produce uranium-based nuclear weapons. This is a CIA assessment, confirming the Bush administration's fears about the accelerated nature of North Korea's secret uranium weapons program. Some intelligence officials believe it could produce a weapon as early as sometime next year. This is based on Pakistan's accounts of its interrogation of A.Q. Khan, the father of Pakistan's bomb, who was pardoned by Pakistani President Musharraf in January. Because when you supply North Korea with all the equipment it needs to build a uranium-based nuclear bomb, you deserve a pardon. You've done enough. The report concluded North Korea probably received a package very similar to the kind the Khan network sold to Libya for more than $60 million. It includes nuclear fuel, centrifuges, and one or more warhead designs. But wait, there's more. No, that was it. A senior American official described it as, quote, the complete package from raw uranium hexafluoride to the centrifuges to enrich it, all of which could more easily be hidden from weapons inspectors than were North Korea's older facilities. The relationship between Khan and North Korea heated up rapidly between 1998 and 2002. Speaking of nuclear weapons, of course, the United States is now relying on trying to get UN weapons inspectors. We're kind of insisting on getting UN weapons inspectors into Iran to see what they're doing with their nukes, their nuclear program. These are the same... something just fell down, ladies and gentlemen. Don't worry about a thing. These are the same UN weapons inspectors we didn't trust to inspect Iraq just about a year ago. Isn't that wild how things change? Speaking of UN weapons inspectors, the United States unsuccessfully tried to pressure the UN chief weapons inspector back then to tell the Security Council that Iraq was in violation of UN resolutions just 2 weeks before the war began. That's according to the inspector involved, Hans Blix. Hans Blix, everybody. On March 6, 2003, the day before Blix was to make his final report to the Security Council, U.S. Assistant Secretary of State John Wolf asked, according to Blix, in a rather discourteous tone, why Blix's agency did not conclude that the discovery of an Iraqi aerial drone and a cluster bomb for delivering chemical weapons were violations of Iraqi obligations. This is what Blix writes in his new book. He said Wolf tossed photographs of them, which further irritated the Swedish diplomat when he tossed the photos on the table, because of the possibility the photos had been leaked by someone on his staff or that his secure fax system had been penetrated. Blix said the cluster bombs were copies of South African munitions imported by Iraq long ago and appeared to be scrap from the past rather than something of current interest. The exchange with Wolf was one of several last-minute maneuvers at the UN that were undertaken to head off the fighting. The policy of containment was abandoned in the case of Iraq, he concludes, and counterproliferation was applied. He also gave an interview this week trying to get to this question that everybody asked, including Donald Rumsfeld. The big three made the rounds of the Sunday morning yak shows this past weekend, Rumsfeld, Powell, and Condoleezza Rice. And Rumsfeld again said, well, why would Saddam Hussein take a chance and forego the money he could have gotten if the sanctions were lifted just by coming clean if he didn't have something to hide, which was something we heard Tony Blair say last year. Here's Blix. The sanctions on Iraq were going to be lifted once the weapons inspectors reported that all weapons of mass destruction were gone. But Iraq didn't trust that that was going to happen. The U.S., according to Blix, often said that the sanctions wouldn't be lifted until Saddam Hussein was removed from power. Therefore, he had no reason to meet the demands of disarmament. Another reason, says Blix, see if this sounds familiar, ladies and gentlemen, see if you heard this on some nationally syndicated radio program on your local public radio station a year ago. Another reason, Blix says, might be that Saddam Hussein wanted to come across as more dangerous than he actually was. Finally, Blix is asked, how did it feel to stand in front of influential world leaders who told you that you have been deceived? Blix, we knew what we knew. Unlike Donald Rumsfeld, who asked today on CNN, when you said a year ago that we knew where the WMDs were, was that right? Well, we couldn't know, he says. You don't know until you're on the ground. So we didn't know what we knew, ladies and gentlemen. It would appear, according to Donald Rumsfeld, Australia's F-18 pilots refused to drop their bombs in dozens of missions during the Iraq War. One of the pilots has revealed. News from beyond the bubble, ladies and gentlemen. The pilots said each of the 14 F-18 Hornet pilots aborted 3 to 4 missions, keeping track of the numbers during the war, often because intelligence given at pre-flight briefings did not concur with what they found at the target. Squadron leader Darrell Pudney described how he and other Australian pilots had to weigh up the life and death decisions in a split second before dropping their bombs. Pilots broke off many missions after they saw the target and decided there was not a valid military reason to drop. It appears there were fundamental differences, according to Australian media, between the U.S.-dominated headquarters and Australian pilots over what constituted a valid military target. Squadron leader Pudney said under Australia's rules of engagement, pilots had to ask themselves on each mission whether it was right to drop their bombs. Each guy would have made that decision once to a half dozen times in the conflict. He would not comment on the reasons missions were aborted, but it seems it was often to avoid killing civilians unnecessarily. He said most decisions were made in the air, but some were command decisions. When I decided not to attack, he said it was because there was some small doubt in the back of my mind saying, is this really what I need to be doing? Is this going to help win the war right now? He said he didn't believe the U.S. Air Force was more trigger-happy, but it operates under different laws of engagement. What's going on at Guantanamo Bay, ladies and gentlemen? Have you heard a lot about this? Four Brits, after much hemming and hawing, Tony Blair finally negotiated the release of four Brits from Guantanamo. They've been held there for 2 years. They were flown back to Britain this week, arrested immediately, questioned for a day, all released, no charges. End of story. Thank you, guys. Nice to see you. They're now telling their story while negotiating for mucho dinero to tell their story again. Tariq Dergul condemned the United States for gross breaches of human rights, which he alleged included interrogation at gunpoint, while a British intelligence official stood on the backs of his legs while he was kneeling. Ouch. 26-year-old Dergul from London is a former care worker. He's in poor physical and mental health after his two-year ordeal. He's believed to have had an arm amputated and have difficulty walking. His account, according to a statement, includes botched medical treatment, interrogation at gunpoint, beatings, and inhumane conditions. His family believe his mental health has been severely affected by the trauma he suffered. The men were beaten, they say, but that was not nearly as bad as the psychological torture. He said the men were asked to sign a confession. They were linked to the Taliban and Al-Qaeda before their release. He said, I would rather have stayed in Guantanamo than sign that paper. A Pentagon spokeswoman described the allegations as simply lies. Colin Powell says he believed the U.S. treated detainees in a very, very humanitarian way. Because we are Americans, Powell said, we don't abuse people in our care, unquote. Because we're Americans. It's just, you know, it's just the way it is. We're better. U.S. authorities have refused to allow independent human rights observers into the military base in Cuba. Because we're Americans. Because we're Americans. We treated the Native Americans well. I'm sorry. I got that one wrong. And now, ladies and gentlemen, is it time for a copyrighted feature? It's way past time, don't you think? The apologies of the week.
We're so sorry.
So many apologies this week, starting, of course, with this one.
To the fans of hockey and the fans of Vancouver, for the kids that watch this game, I'm truly sorry. I don't play the game that way. And I'm not a mean-spirited person. And I'm sorry for what happened.
And he does play the game that way. We saw it. See, when you're apologizing, you can actually say, while you're apologizing, don't believe what you saw. Believe what I'm saying now. That's Todd Bertuzzi of the Vancouver Canucks. Yes, you can call them Canucks. Apologizing for the hit, the blindside punch, and the takedown that resulted in a broken neck, broken collarbone to a Colorado hockey player. Bertuzzi faces criminal investigation and has been suspended for the remainder of the hockey season because he doesn't play the game that way. The American designer of Germany's long-delayed National Holocaust Memorial has apologized for a joke that local Jewish leaders said made light of the Nazi gas chambers. Peter Eisenman, quipped at a meeting of the project's trustees in Berlin last month that his dentist told him that his gold fillings came from the same German company whose former subsidiary supplied Zyklon B cyanide tablets for the gas chambers. Under the circumstances, it was ironic, Eisenman said in New York. Maybe there's an enormous difference between American Jewish humor and present-day German Jewish humor. I have said repeatedly that to anyone who took it as insensitive, I apologize for that. But he says I shouldn't resign. Here's also from Vancouver. Human DNA may have been in meat processed for human consumption at a pig farm at the center of an investigation into Vancouver's missing women. We can't rule out the possibility of cross-contamination, British Columbia's provincial health officer. Where is his apology? There's an apology in here. Somewhere. Oh, yes. There is. I swear. Or not. Yes. Corporal Kate Galliford, spokeswoman for the Royal Canadian Mounted Police task force into the missing women case, refused to use the word remains when speaking of the potentially contaminated meat. She opened the police news conference with an apology to the families for them hearing about it on the news first. From the University of Virginia Daily Cavalier, on the life page of yesterday's paper, we printed a column titled Real Jews Get to the Front of the Buffet Line, which in retrospect falls outside the standards of good taste. We apologize for any offense taken and will hold all content to higher scrutiny in the future. Argentina will compensate children who were detained, stolen, or born in captivity during a brutal 1976-1983 dictatorship. The president, Nestor Kirchner, asked them to forgive the state. We are sorry, we can do no more than ask for forgiveness. Kirchner has also campaigned to lift amnesties protecting officials involved in the dirty war. The latest in the series of apparently unending series of city officials who drive drunk and apologize, San Jose City Councilman Terry Gregory was arrested early Friday morning on suspicion of drunken driving. He was pulled over going 70 miles an hour in a 40-mile-an-hour zone. The only thing I can say is I made a mistake and I'm very sorry about it. I apologize to my friends and colleagues on the city council and the residents of District 7. I'm just thankful that no one was hurt, he said. Also in the apologetic California official department, from Santa Maria, California, home of the future Michael Jackson trial, Supervisor Gail Marshall refused to resign despite impassioned pleas from Chumash Indian members and others condemning her for what they say were racist comments about Native Americans. Marshall again apologized to those offended, and she questioned the tribe's political motives in seeking her removal. Marshall said the tribe was unsophisticated about government, because when you get $300,000 a year for sitting on the couch watching a Lakers game not working, you model that lifestyle to the next generations. Vincent Armenta, leader of the Santa Ynez Band of Chumash Indians, was upset. I don't believe her apology is acceptable. Washington state officials apologized this week for mailing hundreds of letters to retired public employees about their pensions that in some cases mistakenly notified them of their own deaths. On the Larry King Show, Larry, how do you react to those who say you're not apologetic enough? You're apologetic, but not overly apologetic. Jason Blair, I'm immensely contrite and I'm sorry for the damage I've done. I've apologized in the book. I've apologized in interviews. Some people, you know, it seems to me some people would like me to crawl into a hole and disappear forever. That's not in my nature. I'm not sure what more I could do to show people how sorry I am. Have you apologized to the people you've plagiarized from? I've not apologized to the people I've plagiarized from. I've apologized to... Why not? Well, I've apologized. One of the things I did, you know, in the fall of last year was make a list of people I felt had been hurt by this situation. I've slowly begun trying to make amends, and I've started with friends. And as I move from friends, some of my former colleagues, some of the people I plagiarized from, I really need to understand my actions completely, have my heart into these apologies, and, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if I wasn't done apologizing over the next 20 years. A malfunctioning website may have allowed the Social Security numbers, addresses, and other personal information of more than 2,000 University of California applicants to be viewed by other students during this year's application process, U of C officials. We're very distressed about this situation. Hope students will accept our apologies for any concern it may cause them, says UC's Associate Vice President for Student Academic Services. J.C. Chasez of NSYNC is sorry after a leading advocate of the schizophrenic took offense to the title of his just-released solo album. The album is called Schizophrenic. The cover art depicting a musa-haired Chasez in a straitjacket didn't go over too well either. Bill McPhee, publisher of Schizophrenia Digest and a diagnosed schizophrenic, called Chasez's appropriation of the brain disorder a misappropriation and criticized his record label, Jive. I apologize to anyone I may have offended with the title and cover of my album, Chasez said. I'm truly sorry if I've upset anyone. According to Jive, however, neither the offending title nor cover art will be altered. The British Ministry of Defense apologized to the mother of a Marine killed in the war with Iraq after it took almost a year to admit publicly his death was the result of friendly fire. The head of the Christian Civic League of Maine apologized for using the group's website to solicit information about the sexual orientation of lawmakers and other state officials. And Taiwan's opposition nationalist party has been forced to withdraw a presidential election campaign ad featuring a picture of Nazi dictator Adolf Hitler after it drew protest from Jewish groups. Ladies and gentlemen, a bumper crop. The Apologies of the Week, a copyrighted feature.
Grand opening of the newest, most exciting place for health-conscious people in Beverly Hills to enjoy all the most luxurious foods without any of the guilt. From the grand opening of Soy Gras, this is Strictly from Blackwell, and I am Blackwell, and I'm definitely going to be getting all my health-conscious pâtés here. They are done in such a way that you would never dream that they never went through a bird. And it is such a delight to be over with the awards season so early in the year. Whoever at the Academy or wherever thought of moving the Oscars to February out of March, just thank you. Just thank you so much. We can concentrate on the good things of life and not have to worry about what she is wearing to where and what and who is going to be shocking who now. And so we looked forward to the wonderful world of you, and we have wonderful guests today to share that world with you. Dr. Kim Poynter is one of our favorite figures, one of our favorite persons and people in the world of cosmetic and plastic and all sorts of restorative. We don't like the word reconstructive. We like restorative because your face isn't a construction. It's not a store either, but you know what I mean. But we love her, and we love what she's doing, and we love the message and the commitment and the passion that she brings for the message and the commitment that she has. Dr. Kim Poynter.
Thank you.
We've never had you on the program before,
no.
And I feel bad about that.
Oh, you don't have to.
Welcome.
Thank you. Mr. Blackwell, it's so much of a pleasure to be here. Had many a wonderful conversations at the Four Seasons and all sorts of other wonderful places in Beverly Hills, but I've never been invited to the show before.
I know.
You were a naughty boy.
So no, I do have to feel guilty.
Well,
I can't keep it straight. Dr. Poynter, mm-hmm. there's so many people talking about Botox this mm-hmm. and Botox that, mm-hmm. and I'm just wondering, have we gone too far with Botox? Is this something you've been thinking about?
It is indeed,
okay, good.
Mr. Blackwell.
I feel, obviously, in
our profession, our product gets hot. Nothing has gotten hotter in the last 5 years than Botox. When you have John Kerry having to deny that he's had Botox, it couldn't get hotter.
Couldn't get hotter.
And it's being used all over town and all over the country, I imagine. I read in the journals about it being used all over the place.
I read
foreign countries, even Brazil, of course.
Yeah, of course.
And you know, we're in danger of having a generation of people who can't move their eyebrows and crinkle their foreheads even if they want to.
So
I have been thinking about this. I've been working on it.
Okay, good.
And I'm very excited about what we've come up with.
What we feel and we hear from your publicist is just the most incredible. Yeah. Treatment that you have copyrighted? Do you copyright a treatment or what?
We've patented it.
Okay,
don't copyright it.
No, I didn't.
Treatment, of course, medical treatment. You
can
patent it.
Okay.
We trademark the name.
And
that's about all. And then, of course, we administer it.
You give
it available, which is the main.
Okay, so it is called
No Tox. And it's called that, Mr. Blackwell, because it reverses the effects of Botox.
Okay.
It reallows the skin wrinkling and moving functions to be restored.
Okay.
And also because it contains absolutely no botulism toxin whatsoever.
No.
It's made 100% from deactivated salmonella organisms.
Okay.
And so it's called No-Tox.
No-Tox. Mm-hmm. If you're finding that you're looking a little too much like the David Guest exhibit in the Wax Museum,
I'm not gonna say that.
We would go to you. Okay. We would say, Doctor, we want to restore some movement, some expression.
That's right.
To the brow, the forehead area, and you would what? You would inject. How would we take
there
this?
There would be a series of injections.
Okay, good.
It's as I say, it's perfect. It's unbelievably safe. Deactivated salmonella organisms, and we do a series of injections right into the nasal, cranial, labial areas of the face, within 6 weeks, full function has been restored.
Unbelievable.
You can control the level of expression. You can control the level of lines. You know, women are coming to me, Mr. Blackwell, and they're saying, I don't look like a 48-year-old, and I'm 56. So maybe something's wrong here now. And maybe we should do something about it. And that's one of the real reasons that Notox is here.
And came to be. And it is a wonderful example of how, yes, you can turn the clock back into you. And Jason Hagel is with us as well, and we are going to have good conversation with him, because Jason is one of the smartest, most up-to-date, most with-it attorneys that we know of or know to in the Beverly Hills, the greater Beverly Hills area. And Jason is getting into an unbelievably busy line of work these days, because, Jason, you will explain everything to us. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Blackwell. Yes. I've been a divorce lawyer in Southern California for about 22 years.
Okay.
And, you know, divorce law is pretty cut and dry normally in terms of in a no-fault setting.
No,
about in the absence of a prenup.
Of course.
Just dividing the assets
and so forth. You know, because,
It occurred to us about 6 months ago that the gay marriage situation was... just ripe.
Yeah.
And that sooner or later, and this isn't rooting for marriages to fail.
I know.
Say that about divorce lawyers, I'd be a happy man if every marriage was successful.
Would you?
I'd find, you know, tobacco companies to sue or something. gay marriages were going to eventuate, given the odds. In heterosexual marriage, 50%, and in divorce, some percentage, who knows if it was going to be more or less, are going to end in divorce. And somebody needed to specialize in gay divorce. And I happen to be that person, and I happen to be doing that work.
Okay, so you are specializing in gay divorces. Mm-hmm. How many of you, you know, and you're going to, this is very delicate to talk about. Yeah. It's new, and it's... It's fresh, and it's hot, and it's exciting, but it's also a little delicate. How many have you handled while talking about the divorce?
Yes, sir. Yeah. We've done two so far, because there haven't really been that many marriages. Statistically, two is a large number, and we've handled them both.
It's a very, very large number, and we don't know anything about statistics, but we feel that from... just what you're giving off here, Jason. And what has been different? What's different about a gay divorce?
Well,
because I know what's different about a gay wedding. Mm-hmm. We used to do a fabulous business in Mother of the Bride.
Yeah.
Where?
Mm-hmm.
Now we are doing Mother of the Whatever. You know what I mean? And so what is different? But that would not figure.
No.
That would not be a part of what's different about the gay divorce, but you would.
Yeah. What we find is there are custody issues that are different it's not a mother and a father. It's not a husband and a wife. It's an Adam and Steve situation.
Yeah. And also,
the division of property, even in a community property state like California, is a little bit different.
We hate to hear this.
And partly that's emotional. You have every divorce is contentious. Every divorce is unpleasant. That's why God put me on this earth, is to deal with that.
Yeah.
But in a gay divorce, I found in the two that we've handled so far, the level of anger is if anything greater. The disappointment, the feeling that these people were in the vanguard of something, and that they let not only each other down,
they let everybody
but
down.
A movement down just plays upon each other, I find that you know, we have counseling, various sorts of services in the firm, very often we have to just sedate these people just to get them to do depositions. I mean, these are the first sedated depositions that we've done in my 22 years in the business.
Interesting. And a deposit. We're going to find out what a deposition is. But Dr. Kim Poynter, if we want the Notox, Clearly, we have to make an appointment.
That's right.
We have to make the appointment. Mm-hmm. We have to make the commitment mm-hmm. that we have to hide from our friends and our relatives and our neighbors and
It's very subtle.
Okay.
It's not dramatic.
No.
That's why I say it's over a period of a month to 6 weeks.
Okay.
We just gradually dial back in the ability to move these muscles and to create the pattern of these muscles having moved on the cutaneous surface, that is to say the skin.
The skin, which we call
wrinkles.
And
so it's a very natural evolution. Okay. It's not dramatic.
No.
It's not sudden.
No.
It's not shocking. It's not frightening.
No.
It's very natural, and as I say, it's just the deactivated salmonella,
when you say deactivated, mm-hmm. of course this is safe. We know this is safe because mm-hmm. you wouldn't be doing it if it...
That's right.
Is this any... When you say
salmonella,
is this what? From the salmon? Is it from the fish?
No.
Because there's no better fish.
No, there's no better fish, and that's true. But this is not... Salmonella is a foodborne bacterium.
It's okay. It's a bacterium.
And like mm-hmm. botulinum...
Yeah.
It's a bacterium which, in different dosages, can be dangerous, can be toxic.
Okay, but anything.
But in these dosages, can just be so life-affirming.
Okay,
and
this is what we feel.
The first 40 women that have, and two men, interestingly, who have come in for the treatment, for the no-tox treatment, have just, I wish I could show you the letters they've sent me, Mr. Blackwell, it's just... Yeah. It's heartbreaking, and it moves you to tears how relieved these people are to have their muscle control and the evidence of having lived back. I'm giving them back a visual map of their lives. And,
Because,
you don't miss it till it's gone.
Interesting.
Like the song says.
We don't know the song, but we know the feeling. Because we used to hate those lines, and now we say, where are they? They are us. It's like the toy store. Jason Hagel. Mm-hmm. Everybody's saying, mm-hmm. what, gay marriage is good, gay marriage bad. Mm-hmm. We love the civic union. Mm. We love the marriage. What is your take? What is your feeling, more importantly, on all this? Love for you to share.
Okay. Obviously, if it's civil unions, we don't enter into the dissolution of that. That's purely a civil matter, and it can be dealt with in a court clerk's office in about 10 minutes. For purely personal reasons, and have nothing to do with my lifestyle or that of anybody in my firm. We're very much in favor of gay marriage are lobbying vigorously for it.
Okay, good.
We think, it's a civil rights issue for them as well as for us.
As well as for you. It couldn't be fairer and clearer if you actually tried. Jason Hagel, Dr. Kim Poynter. We've had such great conversation, and I would love to just kill the clock because it's killing us in return in advance. Next time, the fall collection's Retro Schmetro, when looking back is almost as frightening as looking ahead. Till then, Strictly from Blackwell. Bye-bye.
Meanwhile, back on this planet, ladies and gentlemen, there is... a bizarre couple of stories from Africa. One involves that plane load of mercenaries, alleged mercenaries, that flew into Zimbabwe. The plane was impounded and the alleged mercenaries were arrested. Supposedly were plotting a coup in the Equatorial Guinea. Like, somebody cares. It's good news. Somebody cares about Equatorial Guinea. Apparently it has to do with... there's Lebanese and some oil things. It's oil. And then there's the story of Jean-Bertrand Aristide ousted or removed or self-resigned as elected president of Haiti, exiled for momentarily in the Central African Republic. He didn't like it. They didn't like it. He is now on his way to Jamaica, still claiming that the U.S. forced him from power. The U.S. says, well, who are you going to believe? Jean-Bertrand Aristide or Colin Powell?
He say he kidnapped. We saving his skin. He say he elected. We say we saving his skin. He say he coming back soon. We say elections are funny things. Sometimes the winner don't win. Harris did he coming to Jamaica. Yeah, he be jamming in the sand. Africa's the mother of us all, man. But just west of Haiti he preferred to land. Just west of Haiti where he take his stand. He say we hired plotters.
We say he hired thugs.
He say what about the poor.
We say rising tide lifts all bugs.
He say real bad guys coming back now.
We say this place needs an army. Cause we're fighting a war on drugs.
War on drugs. And that's harder than fighting it straight. Aristide is coming to Jamaica. He making speeches in the sand. Africa's the mother of us all, man. But just west of Haiti where he take his stand. Just west of Haiti where he take his stand. He say why would he lie.
We say we trust Colin Powell.
He say why.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, that's going to jig the cap on this particular bottle of Le Show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations over NPR worldwide throughout Europe on the USN 440 cable system in Japan, up and down the east coast of North America on the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet, 7.415 megahertz, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network, around the world via your computer. And the internet, wherever you want it, at two different, whenever you want it. What am I talking about? At two different locations, harryshear.com and kcrw.com, and now available as a free download at audible.com/LeShow. Audible.com, where you get all those books downloaded into your thing, your player, I guess. And it would be just like a recount of everything if you'd agree to join with me then. Would you already? Thank you very much, The email address for this broadcast is lemail, L-E-M-A-I-L, at interworld.net. Le Show Internet Services by Steve Mack. Le Show playlists almost always available at the newly refurbished harryshearer.com. Come enjoy the furbishing. Come for the furbishing, stay for the furbishing. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions. See, they can't count the number of minutes on that desk. That's sad. The show, I say, comes to you from Century of Progress Productions. We're going to take this very slowly then. And reaches you each week through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica. Santa Monica? Yes, of course, you've heard of it. Shall I remind you? All right, then. It's recognized around the world, ladies and gentlemen. Say it with me, if you like, as the home of the homeless. So long, everybody.